This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And I've just been having lots and lots of fun at Stratford this week, working on all sorts of new projects. We're expanding our programs in the Maryland area, so we've been working on that, and having quite a bit of luck with that. We also are going to be offering two doctoral programs at Stratford, so we just got that approval through the accreditation group. So we're putting together the official marketing plans. We got a doctorate of IT and a doctorate of business administration, so we're going to put that through the system, and so we'll probably be launching those two doctoral programs in October. So that's cool. Kind of a fun development. I was reading this week about heating your house with nerd power.
What?
You basically let somebody put part of their data center in your house, and you use it as a radiator, and then you don't pay for the electricity that's heating it.
That's an idea.
Actually, it's a pretty clever idea. That turned out to be the idea of the week. And we're going to be featuring this big problem that many, many people are having, getting Wi-Fi running in an apartment.
Right, exactly.
When you've got like 30 different access points all around you, what are your options? How can you do it? Then I'll talk a little bit about the physics behind it and what you can do with that. And there was this mystery radio signal that was baffling astronomers, and they thought it was like some distant galaxy communicating with us, and they discovered it was just something simple. They were a little embarrassed.
You'll tell us what
Yeah, I will. And the website of the week is Plus a Grade. It's how you can, have you ever been on an airplane and then you're sitting there and say, Economy Plus, and you say, I wonder if I could get business class. So it's an auction site. And so you say, well, I'm willing to pay $100 to go up to business class. And so you actually bid against the other passengers for the upgrade. That's actually a pretty good idea.
That's a pretty good idea.
So that's my website of the week.
I'm using business minus.
Usually
business minus, which means I'm in the cargo hold.
Yeah. Well, it's this business class when you're traveling, say, to India, when you're on the plane for 14 hours.
Yeah, that's a lot.
There's a big difference between the cattle car section and the business section on a 14-hour flight. And of course, it was a huge mailbag.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh my.
People were getting him in before the holiday. That's
I
for
know.
Sure.
It's really heavy. Really, really heavy. We got an email from Mary in Bethesda. Dear Doc Schertz, I got a website that I built in 2015, and it's hosted by HostGator. Now, I thought I would make a go at this as a small service business, and then reality sunk in. It's going to take a long time and many lean years before I'm going to get any real revenue out of this. So last week, I got a real job. Well, congratulations, Mary. That's a good idea. But it was a lot of investment and time to build this thing, and I like the site, and I'd like to go back to it someday, and keep building it up. But, I don't think it's worth paying the monthly hosting fees. And so I'd like to find a way to back it up so I can save everything. And then when I want to reactivate it again, I could just reactivate it. Thanks, Mary in Bethesda. Well, Mary, actually what I would do is, as you probably noticed, hosting a business online is slow to build up, but it's really not a full-time job. So since you now have a full-time job, I would think this is an opportunity for you just to tinker around with it on the weekend. So I would probably not recommend that you shut it down. I'd recommend that you use this time when you don't have to have money to really play around and try new things, and maybe you'll discover something that really hits. That's what I would do. Since you've gone this far, I wouldn't shut it down. But if you're just dead set on shutting it down because you don't like those monthly hosting fees, which are probably running you, you know, all of $25 a month probably at this point, what you need to do, you need to back up your WordPress site, and that WordPress site includes both your WordPress files as well as your WordPress database, because WordPress is a database-driven website. You've got all the scripting that's actually accessing the database. So you got the scripting that's the core of the website, and you've got your data. So you've got to back up both elements there. So your site consists of the WordPress core installation, your WordPress plugins, your WordPress themes, your images and your files, any custom-built Java and PHP scripts or any other custom code that you've written, as well as any additional files and static web pages that you may be using. And in your case, the easiest thing to do is to simply download all the files from the server using an FTP client. That's called File Transfer Protocol. It's one of the original protocols that was used on the internet, and you can basically copy all the files from your website to a folder on your computer. And once you get them on your computer, you can zip those files to compress them to save space. And then I would recommend that you back them up someplace else, because one copy on your computer is really not a backup. You want to put those zipped files on an external hard drive. You want to upload them to the cloud or something like that. Now, I know that you probably don't want to buy an FTP client, so I'm going to recommend a very good open source FTP client that works for both Mac and Windows, because I know you got both types of machines. FileZilla.
Ooh.
FileZilla. And you simply go to file, and that you can download that from filezilla-project.org. It's open source and free. And then, of course, when you reactivate the site, you're going to have to install all the security updates for WordPress and the WordPress plugins, because I'm quite certain there will be some. But the site will still work. It just is not going to have the security patches on it. So, you know, it'll be fine, but then you'll just have to patch it once you bring it back up. But best of luck with that, Mary. And I hope you take my advice and tinker with it on the weekend, because maybe in a couple of years, that'll turn into a real business for you. We got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, I own a single-family home and want to know any oddities going around my property when I'm not here. Any oddities? I guess that means strangers walking around the lawn or something.
I guess.
Yeah. And I'm not an electrician, so I prefer something that's easy to install. I'm looking for a wireless camera that can scan the front and sides of the house and capture a pic of anyone on my property. Can you recommend a brand and model? Thanks, Lauren. Well, Lauren, you're talking about looking on your side, the sides of the house. That'll take a camera on each side. In the back of the house, camera on the back of the house, your camera on the front of the house. So commonly, when people want to do this, they have four cameras.
Right.
So that's why you get systems that support four cameras. You're going to need a waterproof camera.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be outside. You're going to need a camera that's motion activated, because you don't want to have it on and recording stuff when nobody's around. You want to have night vision capabilities, so because, you know, people could be walking around at night. Now, that's basically going to be infrared LEDs that turn on. And then you've got the intruder can't see those LEDs because they're infrared, but it lights up the intruder, and then you can see sort of a black and white image of him illuminated by these infrared LEDs. LED stands for light emitting diode, and you normally get the LEDs bright enough so that you can take a movie of somebody out to maybe 30 feet or 40 feet. It, you know, depends on how bright the LEDs are. Then you need some sort of storage device, either storing it on the cloud or storing it in the local hard drive. Now, if you store it on the cloud, there's a monthly fee. You got to pay the monthly fee to store it on the cloud, or you could store it on a local hard drive. Now, I suppose you could get Google Drive, which will give you 15 gigabytes, or you could get Microsoft OneDrive, which gives you 25 gigabytes, and you could store it there, and it would be free if you'd want to link it to that cloud. But I'm thinking you don't want to have all this complexity of figuring out how to do that. So it may be your simplest bet is just to get an external hard drive at home and just plug it in. You get an external hard drive for not much money. So what I'd recommend, and I'll tell you, there are just so, I mean, you start looking at wireless cameras, they're just all over the place, and it really depends on how much you want to spend. So I decided that you probably don't want to have one that's gimbaled and all sorts of super deluxe. You kind of want a low to medium quality. So I thought the D-Link outdoor HD wireless day-night network cloud camera would work. And so it's 720 progressive HD video, which is pretty good video. It's got integrated motion sensing. It's got automated email alerts. So you get an email whenever something's happening. And it's got night vision technology with LEDs. Now, it also comes with a built-in micro SD card, so you could actually record right in the camera itself, which I don't really recommend because you don't want the intruder just to pop out the SD card, and then you don't have anything there. But that does have that option. Now, you have to find some place, and then you're going to need one camera in the front and one on each side and one in the back. That's four cameras. These cameras cost about $150 each, so that'd be $600. Now the cameras have got to go someplace. You've got to store the video. And so D-Link actually has a video recorder module, a D-Link camera video recorder. It will connect up to four cameras because it's made for just your application, and it supports two hard drives. And you can have up to 2 terabytes of storage on your two hard drives. Your two hard drives are going to be about $100 each. And you can get this unit that actually takes the streaming information from your from the cameras and stores to the hard drive. You can get that unit for $90. And then that gives you a complete surveillance system with four cameras. You've got hard drive storage. You've got streaming. You can also log on through that video recorder module. You can log on and you can look at all four cameras at the same time. You can look at them remotely. So I think this is a pretty good option for you. So it's $600 for the four cameras and $90 for that video recording unit, which would be $700. And you need two hard drives, which is $900 for the total package. And then you could you could install that yourself. You're going to need electrical power for these cameras. There's no way to get around that. I mean, it's going to be a Wi-Fi connection from the camera to your Wi-Fi router, but you're going to need electrical connection.
And it's not something you want to do from outside because it'll be another thing that, you know, an intruder could just unplug.
Yeah,
that could be a bit of an issue.
So you probably want to mount this unit on the wall and then on the external wall and then have it mounted on the plug. I mean, I think you're going to have to get an electrician to do do it properly.
Absolutely.
So,
what if there's anything that's solar powered? But then again, it probably wouldn't work very well at night, then, would it?
Well, then you need a battery and everything else. So this is a common problem. And what I gave you is sort of not the cheapest, but not the most. I gave you sort of the most utilitarian one, something relatively easy to configure. And you don't have to have a hard drive at your house, but I'm thinking you probably don't want to have to pay cloud storage for, you know, $20 a month or something.
I have another cheap, easy to install idea.
Okay,
It's called a Rottweiler.
Oh, yeah, that works really well.
Except that they really don't have the video memory card in them, so.
They don't.
No, but they will get rid of intruders.
They'll get rid of intruders, but then that introduces other issues.
It does indeed. There could be a lot of paperwork involved.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. We got an email from a loyal listener. Dear Doc and Jim, my sister started a new job as a proposal writer in the federal government for a contracting firm. Now, she tells me her boss has a folder on the network drive. It's got two volumes, technical and pricing. And it's got their 50-page proposal is in there, and it's maintained and built from that document. So that's a Word document that's in the draft stage, and each writer has to paste in their assigned content. It's not SharePoint. Now, how will this work with 5 to 7 people access the file and interactively putting in content? I'm at a loss. Please help me. Thanks, your loyal listener. Well, loyal listener, this is not a very good way to collaborate because people are going to end up overriding themselves. Now, this collaboration, Microsoft has dealt with this collaboration. Now, they've created a whole bunch of collaboration tools in Office 365. And you could if you had Office 365, everybody in your location could, the document would be stored on Microsoft OneDrive, and you could all edit that document at the same time. You could, and the collaboration tools, and when you're editing a Word document in Office 365, you can edit it when somebody else is on it. You just can't edit the very same paragraph they're on. If they're in a paragraph and you try to edit that same paragraph, it will stop you until they save their work. And so that's a better way to collaborate. Now we have Office 365 at Stratford for all of our students. All of our students get virtual desktops, and then they have Office 365 built in. So they all use that collaboration tool a lot. We also use, and our staff uses it, but we also have Google Docs. Google Docs is a very good option. It's free. And we have a lot of our collaborative work that involves all the campuses on Google Docs. We've got both Word documents as well as spreadsheets. And you can edit those in real time. And you can actually see people making the edits. You can actually see them typing whatever they're doing. This is real-time multi-user editing on Google Docs, and that doesn't cost anything. So you may be able to convince your manager to try out Google Docs for this interactive collaboration because it's free. Microsoft Office is pretty good. Now, Microsoft, of course, would tell you their real collaboration tool is SharePoint, which you noted. And we do have SharePoint also for some of our more important documents like catalogs and things like that. And that has version control. There's a lot more control over the document itself. And so for many things, SharePoint is a good idea. But that costs money. Now, if you are just stuck with this Word document, in the old days how we did it, we just email it around. So somebody would get an email copy of the Word document. They'd paste in their stuff. Then they'd email the next person. They'd paste in their stuff. And you'd get this email chain as the document was constantly updated.
But the problem with that is everybody has to be ready with their stuff when they get the email.
Everybody's got to be ready with their stuff. Now, the second thing you can do is I use versioning on a Word document. Sometimes we do this, even though it's bad practice. I'll have a document that multiple people work on, and I'll put in, and it'll be like file, Dr. Schertz, and then it'll be dot, and I'll put V1.0, V1.2, and I'll keep versioning in the name of the file. So every time I change it,
right,
I change the version number, and then I put the version number in the footer. So if you have a discipline where every time somebody goes to that Word document and they paste in whatever they have done, they save it as a new version, then that means that the old document is not overwritten, and you'll have a whole series of version documents. And then somebody could come in and sort of figure out, look at the final version to make certain it's got everything that's needed, and then they would just go from there. So I think if you're going to use one, if your boss insists on you using this method, which is not really best practice, and she doesn't want you to go to Google Docs or Office 365 or SharePoint, then I would have strict versioning, and then you could survive. So that's it's not an insurmountable problem, just an inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
We got an and you might check with your IT department, and that instead of having them upgrade to the next version of installed Microsoft Office, you might have them go to the Office 365 subscription, and that might be cheaper overall for your company. And it's pretty good because then you've got all your stuff stored online. You can edit it anywhere you want. We got an email from Carl Tyler. Dr. Schertz, I believe I have a good candidate for Tech Talk Radio's profile in IT.
Huh.
His name is William Friedman. Friedman worked for the Signals Intelligence Service in World War II. He and his team were responsible for breaking the Japanese cipher Purple. Freeman had a long history as a cryptologist and later worked at NSA. He's also credited with coining the word cryptoanalysis. Thank you for your podcast, loyal listener, Carl Tyler. Well, Carl, that is a great suggestion. We're going to feature William Friedman today on Tech Talk.
Carl comes up with a lot of great ideas. He may need to be brought on staff here.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Big Voice, you know, we could get rid of Mr. Big Voice and free up some budget space there.
Oh, that is, yeah. I don't know
what he brings to the table anymore.
No, I don't know. He doesn't. He is not really that helpful.
No.
That is a possibility. We got an email from Hong in Ohio.
Uh-oh.
This is another Ohio. You know, we got a whole bunch of Ohio folks up there who must be listening to the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea why this podcast is of interest to that Ohio bunch. But this Hong in Ohio, dear Doc and Jim, I'm having trouble with my router. My connection keeps going down every few days, and I've got to unplug the router and reboot it to fix the problem. How can I just make it work properly? A loyal Tech Talk listener in Ohio, Hong. Well, this is a common problem. Everybody's always rebooting their router. You know, I mean, you hear this all the time. Yeah. Reboot when your Wi-Fi doesn't work, reboot the router. Well, there are a number of things that could be happening. Maybe your internet provider changes your IP address occasionally, and your router doesn't catch on and shift its IP address, and then you don't have internet access. That actually doesn't have. I've checked. I have Verizon. They never changed my IP address, but it's not guaranteed that I get the same IP address. But by and large, once they give it to me, they don't change it. Your router could be overheating, and so make certain your router's it's not an enclosed space.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is an enclosed space and it's sitting on its side, make certain it's sitting on wooden blocks so you've got circulation all around it. You may want to update your router's firmware. Sometimes, you know, people tend to keep routers forever and ever and ever, and they never update the firmware. So you can actually log on to your router. Just go to the web address of your router and log into it with your username and password. And there's usually a place on the menu for checking for updated firmware. If, in fact, you can't find it there, they may have a more archaic method where you have to write down the version of firmware you have. Then you'd have to go to the website of the router manufacturer and look up the firmware and see whether you need an update. So that's a possibility. Another possibility is that you could have too many connections which are being set up for file sharing services. See, people that download, say, music with, say, BitTorrent, for instance, you might be downloading 25 songs at the same time. And so it sets up 25 connections, and you may be overwhelming the router with too many connections. This, by the way, frequently happens when, you know, in hotel routers. Sometimes the Wi-Fi goes down, they've got to reset it, probably because somebody was downloading BitTorrent stuff over that traffic. So you can actually go in there and you can go to your BitTorrent. So if you're doing that, I'm certain, Hong, that if you're doing this, you're only downloading legally things that you own the copyright. You'd not be downloading any movies or any songs that you have no right to. I'm quite certain that you'd be following every single rule. But if you're doing this, you'd log on to your BitTorrent client or your Usenet client, one of these file sharing clients, and you can limit the bandwidth which it uses. You can also limit the number of simultaneous connections. So you can actually control your client so it just doesn't overwhelm your router. And, of course, you could just buy a new router, which
there's
is,
that.
You know, if you want to throw in the towel, you could just buy a new router. Now, the last thing to do, and there's one guy I talked to, he was always having to reboot his router like every other day. So he just got a little outlet timer on his router, and at 3 in the morning, it would just turn the router off and turn it back on again, and he would reboot it automatically at night. And after he did that, he never had to reboot it himself again because it would reboot at night. That's actually a pretty clever idea.
Yes.
It didn't actually solve the problem. It just lived with the problem in a way that didn't bother him. Listen, we love your emails.
Indeed.
Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll either cover you on the show or I'll send an email to you directly.
Thank you for listening this Saturday morning on a holiday weekend. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Well, What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University Innovative Approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for...
Profiles in IT.
Okay, today we're going to talk about William Frederick Friedman. He was actually born, when he was born, he was Wolf Frederick Freeman, was his original name. So William Frederick Freeman is known as the Dean of American Cryptology. He was born, as I told you, Wolf Frederick Friedman in September 24th, 1989 in Moldavia, Russia. Now, actually, Moldavia at that time was not part of Russia. Russia went in, you know, they're doing it again. Russia went in there and sort of took over the country, and then it ultimately became part of Russia. Moldavia would rather have been part of Romania, actually, but then, such as it was back around World War I, it got connected with the Russian Empire. He was born there September 24th, 1891. Now, his family was Jewish, and there was a huge amount of anti-Semitism there at the time. So his family fled Moldavia, and they moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1892, when William was only 1 year old. And they changed his name from Wolf to William.
I don't know.
I think Wolf might have been a traditional Jewish name, and they wanted to make him not look so Jewish. Mm-hmm. I think it was sort of a carryover from the anti-Semitism in Moldavia.
Sure.
That's what I'm going to guess. So Friedman was introduced to cryptography by reading a short story by Edgar Allan Poe called The Gold Bug. The gold bug. And so what happened, this guy was bitten by the gold bug. And when he was bitten by the gold bug, he just wanted to find gold treasure. And he had the gold bug on a leash, and it was taking him where he had to go. But as part of his puzzle, in order to find where the gold treasure was located, he had to solve these coded messages. And so this was sort of when cryptography was coming out. And so you had to know a little bit of cryptography to read these coded messages, and he ended up finding some pirate treasure. But after reading The Gold Bug by Edgar Allan Poe, he said, "You know, I kind of like this cryptography stuff," because he was sort of interested in mathematics anyway. So he went to Michigan State University, and then he got a scholarship to go to Cornell and study genetics. You see, genetics is sort of a code. You know, the DNA is sort of like the biological code of how the body goes. So you could see somebody who's interested in code and code patterns and all. It's sort of like genetics. There's a similar mathematical thought process behind both. So he went to Cornell, got a degree in genetics, and then he joined Riverside Labs in September of 1915 as head of the genetics department. Now, at that time, He had to work. He was working on whether moonlight affected wheat. So he was planting wheat during different periods of the full moon, half moon, new moon, that sort of thing, to see whether that had effect. That was one of his genetics research projects. But the guy who owned the labs had some like pet projects. And one of the pet projects was they wanted to look for secret messages in some letters that have been written by Sir Francis Bacon during the Elizabethan era. And so he started studying these things, and he actually went to England to study it. And while he was there studying secret messages in Sir Francis Bacon's letters, he met a woman who was also a cryptologist. And, you know, he said, you know, I have to tell you, when I go to a bar, I just don't meet very many cryptologist women. I mean, it was like love at first. He said, a woman who loves cryptology?
I got to get this one.
It was like love at first sight. So he married her.
Wow.
Her name was Elizabeth. He married her, and so they came back to, by the way, it turned out to be a wild goose chase. There were no secret messages in Sir Francis Bacon's letters, but that didn't matter. He managed to find his wife, who was also a cryptologist, and she continued in cryptology her whole career. So when he came back to Riverside Labs, he then led two departments. He was department head for codes and ciphers. He was also department head for genetics. He wrote a series of 23 papers on cryptography, including the first description of the index of coincidence. And what that means, have you ever noticed, like, if you're just doing, say, letter transcript, if you just say, take every letter and say it's another letter, so like substitution deal, you can look at the distribution of letters. And we know that if you write, say, a document, that the number one letter that shows up is A. So if you look at this frequency chart on letter distribution, you can kind of guess which letter is which.
Mm-hmm.
So he analyzed that, and he wrote a whole paper on how to do that. And so he actually began this index of coincidence. Now he became the unofficial. The Riverbank Labs became the unofficial cryptographic center for the U.S. government during World War I, because the U.S. government at that time, there was no National Security Agency, there was no Signals Intelligence Agency, there was nothing. So they said, well, this guy seems to be like this cryptography. He wrote these 23 papers. So let's make him the official cryptographic, let's make this the official cryptographic center for the government. And so they funded them. And while he was there, the first code that he worked on, he worked on a German-funded code that was written for Indian radicals. These are Indian radicals who were in the U.S. These are from the country of India, who were trying to ship arms to India to help India get independence from England. Okay, so he cracked that code. That was the first code that he came up against. Then the U.S. said, you know, maybe we better set up our own cryptological service. So they basically set that up, and then Friedman was asked to train, you know, all the initial employees, because he was like a one man band at that point. So in order to support a program and to train more people, he wrote a series of monographs. He completed seven of them by 1918. Then he was so inspired by this mission to help the government decrypt enemy messages. He enlisted in the army, and he went to France to serve as the personal cryptographer for General Pershing. He returned to the... Now, who would have thought that? The personal cryptographer for General Pershing.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that Pershing had it. And that was back in 1919. He returned to the U.S. in 1920, and he published the eighth monograph. That was a complete set of eight that he had written there to train all the new recruits for the cryptological service. In 1921, he became the chief crypt analyst for the War Department, and he actually came up with that word, crypt analyst.
Well, when you're the first one, you get the name.
I am the chief crypt analyst for the War Department. He actually coined several terms, including cryptanalysis. And now, during the 1920s, he analyzed and cracked the code for cipher machines that were based on kind of a typewriter, and they have rotating disks, and it would type a different letter. You'd type it in, and as these disks would rotate, it would pop out another letter. These were These were mechanical machines that were used for coding. And he analyzed these, and he discovered that if you had one of the disks that would rotate one slot every time you'd have another letter, that and if these were rotating in a certain way, he could actually solve the code quite easily. And he actually cracked the code on a number of these machines. Then he developed a machine that didn't have that regular ring rotation that made it so easy to predict. And he developed a machine called SIGABA. I don't know what that stands for. SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
You need a cryptologist.
And it was immune to the attack that he discovered. And that became the U.S.'s highest security cyber machine in World War II. In 1939, the Japanese introduced a new cipher machine that wasn't based on these rotating disks. It was based on the kind of switches that you've got in telephone switching networks. And it was a much more difficult system to, machine to crack. And they called it Purple. And he spent several months on it. He and his team figured it out. And what they did, they figured out what telephone switch was used. And they created an exact copy of Purple, even though they'd never seen the original one, and it could actually create the same code. And they used it to decrypt all the Japanese messages before and after the Pearl Harbor attack. For instance, the day before Pearl Harbor, the Japanese sent a message to their embassy saying that they were going to stop all communication with the U.S. immediately. And they sent this to the Japanese embassy the day before the Pearl Harbor attack with the idea that they would deliver it to the U.S. embassy the day after the attack.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, they sort of had a clue that something was going on, but nobody did anything with that particular message. But it turned to be a very strategically important development. Now, the U.S. gave the British a copy of the Purple machine, which they had created, and then the British gave them in exchange the details of the German coding machine called Enigma.
Mm-hmm.
And so the British had decrypted the Enigma cipher. In 1949, he became the head of cryptographics for the U.S. Armed Forces Security Agency. And in 1952, he became the chief cryptologist for the National Security Agency. And that was the year they created NSA, 1952. And he was chief cryptologist. Now, he produced a series of classic textbooks on military cryptanalysis, which he used to train NSA students. He also encouraged NSA to develop supercomputers because, the Brits were getting into this whole supercomputer business. Mm-hmm. And he was inducted into the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame. And there's even a building named after William and Elizabeth at the NSA complex Fort Meade.
How about that?
Yeah. So there you go. Everything you want to know about William Frederick Friedman,
that is very
known as the Dean of American Cryptology.
Well, I hope you're paying attention because there's free food riding on your knowledge coming up here on the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk. Presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu.
or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Welcome back to Classroom of the Airways.
Yes.
And, of course, if it's a classroom, there is going to be a pop quiz, which we in education call an assessment. Earlier in the show, I talked about William Frederick Friedman, the Dean of American Cryptology. He was actually interested in cryptography since childhood. What story did he read that piqued his interest in cryptography? Now, if you get the correct answer to that, you'll get two tickets to fine dining at either the Scoffier Dining Room, the Karim Dining Room, or else our new dining room at the Alexandria campus.
Oh, no kidding. Is there a name for it yet?
I don't know. I think there is, but I don't know what it is. I'm going to check on that.
Okay, never mind. I was going to say something smart, but I think I'll refrain. So you need to get the answer to us now. If you're calling from west of Moldavia, Russia, it's 877-936-9333. East of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 877-936-9333. Everybody else can call us on the wild card line, which, of course, is indeed 877-936-9333. Of course, Doc, I think you have an idea.
That's right. If you're calling from the Falkland Islands and you really want to have an encrypted call, you can reach us by using Skype. Simply connect to Tech Talk Radio 1, and your call will be forwarded directly to the studio free of charge.
Let's see what happens now, because I am now dialing Tech Talk Radio 1.
Okay, that'll be an interesting
iPad.
That'll be an interesting thing
it's
to
ringing.
Have happen.
You hear that ringing in the background?
Yeah, I hear the ringing in the background, so we'll see whether this actually works.
Let me see if it's showing up on the call screener here, because that would be interesting. I think it may be showing up here. Okay, all right.
Wow.
Let's see what happens if Andrew, I think, has somebody on the phone now.
Okay, so what we're doing, we were just checking that Skype connection. What we've done, I've set up that account, Tech Talk Radio 1, and then I have it forwarded using Skype out to the studio.
Right.
So the listener simply can call that account free, and I pay the Skype out charge to the studio for 2 cents
a
minute.
Hey, Andrew, do you see another line ringing in there? Yeah, can you pick it up?
So this is actually the first time that we've ever tested this out here.
No, because we came up with a quiz question. Hi, Andrew. We're calling you on Skype. I just want to make sure that it works. Okay, thanks for playing along. We'll see you later.
You know,
all right, Doc.
I have to tell you, Jim, we probably should have checked that off the air, but actually,
we probably should have checked that 7 years ago, since nobody's ever called it before.
Okay, this is the thing, Jim.
Yeah,
anything I do always works. So why would I even bother to check
okay,
it?
Okay, all right.
Why would I even bother to check it?
I think the concern was that there was actually money on the account, so I just burned up money.
I tell you, if my IT department ever heard that, they're probably laughing in the halls
now.
That's
very funny. Okay. Well, you know what? It's laboratory testing.
That is totally valid. Okay, let's talk about troubleshooting your Wi-Fi in an apartment. Mm-hmm. This is actually a big problem that a lot of folks have. They, you know, and so like if you're in a single family house, you turn on your Wi-Fi, you've got yours, maybe one at the neighbor, and there's never a problem to go on to a different channel. You use, if you're using the 2.4 gigahertz bands, which are the original bands for Wi-Fi, you can pick, there are 11 channels, but you normally pick a 6 or 11, because those are the only three non-overlapping channels. And if your neighbor's on 11, you use 1. It's not very hard to get 2.4 gigahertz to operate in the house. But when you move to an apartment, there could be 30 access points all around you.
Sure.
And you might have 10 people on each of those channels, and you're sharing that bandwidth. And so you have, and especially if your neighbors are watching Netflix movies or downloading stuff, there's hardly any bandwidth left over, and you just sit there with a connection which is slow as Moses. So that's the problem. So you've got, there are several options that you have. I'm going to kind of walk down all the options.
Mm-hmm.
There, the first option is you could try to shield your device from the other access points. Because the whole thing in a connection, it's signal to noise. And the other access points are viewed as noise. So what you can do, and it turns out that aluminum foil acts as kind of a reflector. So you can actually make little, you can put little parabolic dishes on your antenna. You can put aluminum foil behind your arrangement. And there's a website called freeantennas.com. And they have all sorts of beam-forming techniques that you can use on your router.
Now, if I wear a tinfoil hat when I'm using my device, will that increase reception on the other end?
No, it won't. But it'll keep all the Wi-Fi out of your head.
That, I'm concerned yeah. about how that could affect me long term.
So what could very easily happen? It might be that all of the Wi-Fi access points are in one particular direction. So you could sort of direct your router to be looking out of the building so you're not looking at them, and you could put a reflector, a parabolic reflector behind your router, and you may be able to do some beam, it's called beam forming, by the way, when you're in microwave. You could do some beam forming so that it only sees whatever you want it to see in your apartment. Now, the other thing that, that won't stop you from seeing what, you know, your neighbors above and your neighbors below. So what I do is I tend to get a higher gain antenna. You know, you got these little, you look at these antennas, they're like straight sticks, those dipole antennas. So I've got a stick at home, which is about 18 inches, and it's a 10 dB. It's a 10 dB antenna.
Aren't you special?
Okay. I am. It's a 10 dB. Okay, by the way, let's talk about dBs, decibels. Every 3 dB doubles the signal.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to 9 dB, so 3 dB doubles it. 6 dB, it's doubled again. That's a factor of 4. Then 9 dB would be doubled again, be a factor of 8. So you go to 10 dB, you've got 8 times the signal. That's what it is. So all that means is that so if you've got a dipole antenna, your beam is sort of like a donut going in all directions, and by making it taller, you're just making your donut skinnier, sort of more like a pancake donut.
Right.
And so you don't see who's above you and below you. And if you put a reflector behind it, you can do it. So that's all called beam forming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got my high gain antenna. I can plug my high gain antenna into my laptop. And I've also got a juiced up amplifier there, and I can see 20 or 25 channels all around me at my neighborhood. But if I just use my regular antenna on my laptop, I only see myself and my immediate neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's another frequency that is available for Wi-Fi. It's at 5.8 gigahertz. So you got the 2.4 gigahertz and the 5.8 gigahertz. Now, the 5.8 gigahertz, these are both bands that are not unregulated bands by the FCC. So there's a lot of stuff in these bands. Like, another thing is that 2.4 gigahertz are these wireless telephones.
Right.
Are 2.4 gigahertz.
Sure.
A lot of people have speakers that are 2.4 gigahertz. So you could be eating up 2.4 gigahertz with all kinds of different devices.
Speakers as in like Bluetooth stuff?
Not Bluetooth, but there are speakers that actually send the signal around at 2.4 gigahertz using your Wi-Fi connection. So at 5.8 gigahertz, that's 802.11a, you have 24 channels, but these are non-overlapping. These are actually 24 different channels. Now, about half of them you can't set. They're called dynamic frequency selection. That's because the 5.8 gigahertz bands also overlap some of the emergency responder bands.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, in order to get this approved, they have to say, okay, the channels that overlap the emergency responder ones are dynamically allocated. So if there's an emergency responder on it, it gets off of it. So, but you can actually set up the other ones, just not the ones that overlap emergency responders. There are 24 non-overlapping bands. So the fact is, you could probably find a band in your apartment that was not used by anyone else if you were at 5.8 gigahertz.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are two kinds of routers that you can get. You can get a dual band router that would be 2.4 gigahertz and 5.8 gigahertz. It's dual band, but one radio. So the router decides, am I going to be at 2.4 now or at 5.8? And it just depends what's around there. Or you could get a dual radio router that would be transmitting at both 5.8 and 2.4 simultaneously because it has two radios. So if you're in an apartment, you're probably going to want to get the dual radio, not the dual band, because anything that happens is going to make it flip back to 2.4. Like, for instance, your iPhone operates at both 2.4, iPhone 5 and up operates at both 2.4 or 5.8. 4S operates at only 2.4. It's only a single frequency. 5 and up, it's dual band. And you can't control where your iPhone is transmitting. So maybe your iPhone's going to pick 2.4. That's going to kick your router down to 2.4. And so then all of a sudden, if you're trying to watch a movie and you need the bandwidth, your router, your dual band router, is going to flip back to 2.4, not stay at 5.8.
All right, here's a question. I have two iPhones. One, my old iPhone 4, which I use for, you know, Wi-Fi stuff,
yeah,
and this one. Mm-hmm. So if I went with a dual radio thing, could I use both iPhones hooked up to the...
Yeah, because both radios would be working.
They'd be working on different
That's
radios.
Right. But if you went with a dual band, your 4 is going to pull your system back to 2.4, and it'll never stay at 5.8.
Important safety tip.
Which is... Now that, but the dual radio router is going to cost you maybe $150, whereas a dual band is $80.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you're basically paying for two radios.
Right.
So it's going to be a little bit more expensive. So those are really the... Now the other thing is that 5.8 gigahertz signals are attenuated more as you go through walls. So you would not, say if you had a whole house, you would not use 5.8 gigahertz to light up a whole house because it would be attenuated. But if you're in an apartment, it would probably work.
Mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
The other thing that, but placement is going to be fairly significant because you're going to get peaks and valleys of the signal. So what I do on my laptop, I install NetStumbler, and it gives me signal to noise. And when I want to map out my location, I walk around the house and I measure the signal to noise of my mm-hmm. Wi-Fi signal all over the house. And then I can and it's amazing. You can just move your antenna slightly and you can dramatically alter the signal to noise because there are all kinds of interference effects. So this is a lot of things that you could do. Oh, the other thing that's really that you should be mindful, a lot of times people will get, say, a high-speed router. Maybe they'll be 802.11g.
Mm-hmm.
That's 54 gigahertz. And they'll say, yeah, now I got this high-speed router. But they've got one old laptop that's 802.11b, which is the old slow 10 gigabit per second device. Everything slows down to the slowest device. So if you want to have a high-speed throughput, you got to get rid of all the old legacy devices. So there you are, probably everything. More than you'd ever want to know about Wi-Fi in an apartment.
There you go. All right, we've had somebody on hold, kindly waiting. Whoa, let's turn that down just a tad. Let's go to line one. This is Carol in Silver Spring. Good morning, Carol. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thank you for waiting.
Very good. Yes, earlier in the show, I was talking about William Frederick Freeman, the Dean of American Cryptology. What short story did he read that got him interested in cryptography?
He read The Gold Bug by Edgar Allan Poe.
That is correct.
Congratulations, Carol. You're the winner. Dr. Schertz, tell her what she's
won. You
win
two tickets to Fine Dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, or the Karim Dining Room, or else that unnamed dining room in Alexandria campus, which I'll find out shortly.
It's not Arby's, is it?
No, it is not.
Okay,
not
all right,
Arby's.
Just checking.
No, not Arby's.
All right. Carol, thank you for listening. Hang on a second. Andrew Mitchell, our adjunct professor for prize distribution and crowd control, will take your call and get your information. Doc, based on the time, I think what we should do here is just continue on with the broadcast.
Okay, that
and
makes
we'll just take
good.
It right up to the top of the hour.
So this is pretty much like an executive radio
it's
decision.
It's like an executive programming decision.
Yes, okay. I think we'll just do that.
And, mm-hmm.
Here's the idea of the week. I talked about that briefly earlier. Heating with nerd power.
Yes.
Now, that's just not putting a bunch of nerds in the room. And,
No. Body heat, no.
No, it's not body heat. No,
no.
See, we all know that computers produce heat,
mm-hmm.
and servers produce a lot of heat. So when you've got a data center, it's like a furnace, and a lot of the expense is cooling the data center, which is why they're, putting data centers in cold climates. But it turns out that heat could really be useful. I mean, aren't there a lot of people in their homes, and they're paying for electric radiators around the house? Wouldn't it be great to have a radiator there and you wouldn't have to pay for the electricity?
Exactly.
So this was the nub of the idea. Somebody got the idea. It was a Dutch firm, and the name of the firm is called Nerdalize. Nerdalize. You can nerdalize your house. Jeez. Oh, yeah, I'm nerdalizing my house. And what they did, they basically created a distributed data center. They would take a computer, they would seal it up, and they would wrap it in a radiator. And you could flip a switch, and when you want the heat, all of the radiation from those hot computers would heat your room. Now, if it's summertime, you don't need the heat. You flip the switch, and it goes to a heat exchanger outside, so it doesn't make your house hot. Now, the data centers are estimated to amount to, listen to this, 1.5% of global energy consumption is for data centers, and all that heat is being wasted. So this Nerdalize solution is actually pretty clever.
Very clever.
Now, they've just run a year-long pilot, and they were basically doing data crunching for the Leiden University Medical Center. And they were doing calculations on protein and gene analysis. It was like a genetics kind of research. And so it looks like these are quite effective. All of these distributed computers are connected to the data center using fiber optic links. And so they're basically allowing people, so what it is, people buy, they purchase the radiator, say for $200, they install it in a room in the house they want to heat, and then they don't pay for any electricity for it. It heats the room. So they get free electricity, they just pay for the radiator device. So they're just coming off with this idea, but I think this is a very clever idea. Now there's security issues. People may not want to have their data distributed around and all this and that. So they've got the they try to make the computers secure so you can't break into them. But you probably wouldn't do nuclear research on this kind of system. But this kind of research they were doing made a lot of sense. So let's talk about this mystery radio signal that baffled astronomers. This is really interesting. This at Parkes Laboratory in New South Wales, Australia, they pick up these mysterious radio signals. And they would always happen at a certain time. And they gave them a name. They called them peritons. Peritons. And they were millisecond transient of some sort of mysterious origin. And these peritrons, they couldn't figure it out. And they actually thought they might be something far away. It might be lightning strikes. It could be something. And this has been going on for 17 years. They had these mysterious peritons. Okay, it turned out that they would always occur around lunchtime. And what they discovered was when the workers would go into the lunchroom and cook something in the microwave, if they would open the microwave while the microwave oven was on, while it's still on, just open the oven, there's a moment when microwave waves leak out of that cavity because you just opened it up, creating the periton.
Holy cow, this could be...
So they have written papers on the periton, and it was all caused by guys opening up the microwave oven at lunchtime.
Well, I'm glad to hear it wasn't messages from the Martian
monster
people.
So there you go.
People.
That's just sort of the fun observation of the week. Listen, we love your letters. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'd love you to go to the Stratford University website, which, of course, is at stratford.edu. Take a look at the programs and tell them that you heard all about their programs on Tech Talk Radio.
Indeed. If you tuned in late today and would like to hear this program again in its entirety, it'll replay at 2 o'clock today. See you next week here on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFMHD2 Manassas, WTLPFMHD2 Braddock Heights Frederick, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics. Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO.
Federal News Radio's DoD Wednesday. At 3, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, a discussion with senior managers about how the department meets its mission. At 4, in-depth host Francis Rose brings you Pentagon Solutions, a smart discussion on the issues and challenges of the defense community. Plus daily DoD updates, mornings and afternoons, Monday through Friday. DoD Wednesday on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
This is indeed Federal News Radio. Coming up today, we've got Nationals baseball as they continue their series at home to host the Phillies. The coverage starts today at 3:30 here on Federal News Radio. And, of course, it's going to be a great day for baseball. Sunny and nice today. High of 72 degrees right now. Not a cloud in the sky outside our studios in Northwest. 60 degrees here at WFED.
Tech Tuesday on